In 1521, at the Diet of Worms, Martin Luther was asked to recant his writings. Luther responded, "Unless I am convinced from the sacred scriptures that I am in error, I cannot and will not recant. Here I stand. I cannot do otherwise. God help me. Amen." Will you stand with us as we proclaim these Reformation truths in the 21st century? You can take your stand by becoming a monthly or annual contributor to Issues Etc. To find out how you can become an Issues Etc. confessor, apologist, reformer, or patron, check out the donate page of our website, issuesetc.org. Just look for the picture of Martin Luther posting the 95 Theses. Help us proclaim the solas of the Reformation, Scripture, faith, grace, and Christ alone. Here we stand, Issues Etc., and you.
This bill, for the first time in 30 years, allows for the taxpayer funding of abortions.
When Christians say, "I'm not going to get involved in those things," what we've done, we have now not only abdicated responsibility, but we have absolutely given confirmation to the utter destruction of everything we're afraid to touch.
Today we are celebrating the birth of our Prophet Muhammad, who was born on this day. It's a great day of the Muslim world. The Prophet gave us this religion, which is a religion of peace.
It's true that he was a violent man. In fact, he was, if you will say, the first Muslim terrorist.
Southern Illinois truck drivers who love Issues, etc.
It was a phenomenon that people observed almost all through Pope John Paul II's long tenure as pontiff. From the very beginning, he had an appeal to young people. Young people, the youth of the world. World Youth Day became a regular fixture for that pope, and it became a youth day. When they showed up, it was Pope John Paul II, rock star. How do we account for his popularity, especially given the fact that a recent poll of Roman Catholic young people shows that at least on the issue of objective morality, they don't necessarily agree with what that pope and the present pope had to say, that there is an objective morality in the world. We're going to talk about that, among other things, with Terry Mattingly for the first part of this hour of Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. It's March the 5th, Friday afternoon. Terry Mattingly will join us for about 30 minutes, and then we'll play Issues Etc., Soundbite of the Week. It's a simple game we play every Friday here on Issues Etc. We play four Issues Etc. soundbites. You listen, then you call, email, or Twitter us, and you vote. You tell us who you are, which one you're voting for, and why. The best vote on this Friday will get the LPR bundle package. That's an I Have Issues t-shirt, an Issues Etc. travel mug, an Issues Etc. pin and bumper sticker. Our call-in number for the next hour, 1-877-623-6943. Talk back at issuesetc.org or Twitter us at issuesetc. Terry Mattingly is director of the Washington Journalism Center at the Council for Christian Colleges and Universities, author of the weekly On Religion column for Scripps Howard News Service, and founder of GetReligion.org and author of the book Pop Goes Religion. Terry, welcome back.
Good to talk to you again.
You have written recently about Pope John Paul II, the late pope, and I remember him being wildly popular with young Catholics. He would go to Europe, he would tour in the United States occasionally, and the crowds of young people that would come to him, he had a real affinity for him. Did young Roman Catholics believe everything that John Paul II taught?
I would back up 1 second and say that I think in a media defined age, I think it's possible to say that young Catholics certainly love celebrity. And there's no bigger celebrity in the world of Catholicism than the Pope. I mean, so to some degree, being in the presence of a man who, especially in the first half of his papacy and on into the, up say through World Youth Day, say in the early 90s, this was an intensely charismatic man. And I think they certainly responded to that. The survey that you're talking about, the study of young millennials, which is focusing on young adults, as opposed to, say, World Youth Day, is primarily people roughly between the ages of, say, 14 and 20, you know, would be the ages there. The millennials study is beginning to tiptoe into the ages of people who are getting out into college and into the workplace. So it's 18 to 29, which tends to be a different demographic. The other thing that it's really hard to tell from that study is what difference there is between church-going young Catholics and young Catholics in general. But, I mean, simply stated, young Catholic millennials seem to be even more socially liberal than the rest of the American population as a whole, a population that would include secular young people as well as, say, young evangelicals or something like that. But there are some stunning numbers in that millennial study the Knights of Columbus had the Marist folks do. And the one that jumped out at me was that 82% of Catholic millennials, people between 18 and 29, affirmed the statement, morals are relative. There are no definitive right and there is no definitive right and wrong for everybody. So 82% rejected a statement of absolute truth. The subject I opened with the fact that's the subject of John Paul's most famous encyclical, Veritatis Splendor. Yet the minute you see that 82%, you then turn right back around and find that a generation that is in large part defined by divorce and by broken families, while they say they don't believe in absolute truth, 91% of Catholic millennials said that adultery is always wrong. Obviously, have two contradictions there. It's hard to believe that adultery is always wrong if you don't believe that anything is always wrong.
So
right?
Do you get the sense that they don't really know what they're saying when they claim that morals are relative?
I think they're saying what they feel, and that doesn't have anything to do with whether there is any linear logical content to the two statements they're making. And as such, I would argue that they're pretty typical of about 70% of Americans.
What about older Catholics?
There we have better data, because most of the time when you're dealing with older Catholics, you're dealing with material that's broken down at the very least by, you know, how often the Catholics go to church. So in this study, you have some other, you have a breakdown between Catholic adults in general versus Catholic adults who go to church at least once a month. 54% of the people who go to church at least once a month were willing to say morals are fixed and based on unchanging standards. I personally thought it was kind of broad making that only going to church once a month in a faith that, you know, up until Vatican II, for sure, had a heavy emphasis on weekly Mass, at the very least. I always like to break Catholics down by ex-Catholics or non-practicing Catholics, kind of cultural Catholics, weekly Catholics, and then either daily Mass or truly sacramental Catholics who are consistently going to confession. That's, you know, where I've always tried to break it down.
How did young Catholics come out on the issues of sexual morality in particular? You mentioned their views are strong on adultery, but what about premarital sex? What about sex outside, not only outside the bounds of marriage, but also outside the bounds of a man and woman relationship?
Yeah, once again, they were to the left of generally defined American millennials. The figure that jumped out, of course, is that in terms of premarital sex, only 20% of young Catholics thought that was wrong, and 35% thought that actual sexual relationships between homosexuals were wrong, morally wrong.
Pope Benedict XVI has talked about a dictatorship of relativism. It sounds like he's on the mark fairly well. What does he need to say to begin the conversation with these young Catholics on the issue of absolute moral standards?
Well, to be perfectly honest with you, I don't think there's anything the Pope can do. At some point, this has to be something that occurs at the level of local parishes, and just as important, it has to be something that happens in Catholic homes. I mean, if the message isn't consistent there, and I have Catholic friends who tell me they hardly ever hear sermons that have anything to do with any kind of defense of the church's moral teachings. I think to some degree, especially in an American and European context, the Catholic Church has gotten kind of gun-shy.
On Pope Benedict XVI, he has recently talked about cyberspace, about the use of it and the right use of it. What does he have to say to the priests of the Catholic Church?
Well, first of all, he wanted them dialoguing with their people, you know, in some way. And I guess you could make a case that he was attempting to say to his priests, get out there. Get out there in the context of where your people are and do something to defend the faith. I guess it would be hard for a priest to say something online, to put something in writing, and then not be expected to affirm it from his own pulpit. So I think to some degree, the Pope is challenging priests to put their beliefs in writing, which, frankly, to a lot of American priests, is probably sounds pretty intimidating, because it's hard to deny what you put in print.
It is kind of a, I mean, a little bit of a humorous picture that pops up in one's mind, given the fact that even in the 21st century, the Roman Catholic Church is, not to mix my metaphors, but kind of Byzantine in its way of looking at itself, and it's just kind of funny to picture a Roman Catholic priest sitting blogging or Twittering.
I think it's interesting that a couple of American bishops are actually getting pretty good at this. I mean, that some of them have excellent websites, and one of the most interesting prelates in the American church, the cardinal at Boston, actually has a quite excellent photography and journal online that is simply called Cardinal Sean's Blog at bostoncatholic.org. And I've seen samples of what he has to say at that blog show up in a number of different media contexts, I mean, which at the very least puts him on the record and puts him in a place that reporters can get to him, even if they can't, you know, run down the Cardinal of Boston, you know, on a cell phone or on a, you know, a telephone. So once again, I think that's an example of what the Pope is trying to get people to do, which is put themselves in a place where people know how to find out what they're thinking.
When we come back, more with Terry Mattingly, we'll talk a little bit more about the Vatican and cyberspace. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc. It's Friday, March the 5th.
Ah, the sounds of rich liturgy and historic Christian worship. What a way to spend a Sunday morning. At Trinity Lutheran Church in Millstadt, Illinois, you'll find authentic Christianity as you hear the preaching of Christ crucified for the forgiveness of your sins. Come, join us Sunday mornings at 9 and Monday evenings at 7:30, and find out more about Trinity Lutheran Church, Millstadt, Illinois, at trinitymillstadt.org.
These days, value affords me a new attitude. It lets me appreciate that I can start my day with more than a $6 cup of coffee, and that I officially have permission to skip dinner out to spend time talking with my family over Casserole Inn. Concordia Publishing House offers Christian products that help me focus on what matters most. Visit any of the three Concordia bookstores downtown in Kirkwood and on the campus of Concordia Seminary in Clayton, or shop online at cph.org and find out what a new value attitude looks like in your life.
Luther had Wartburg. We have Collinsville. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Have you heard of the CLCC? In Hosea 4, we see, "My people are destroyed by lack of knowledge." The Confessional Lutherans for Christ's Commission can help educate Lutherans on being Lutheran. We treasure our Lutheran beliefs and think that all Lutherans would if they learn what we believe, teach, and confess. So visit our website, www.theclcc.org. Check out what we have to offer. Get on our mailing list, or better yet, join us. And maybe encourage your pastor to hold a seminar in your area. Just go to theclcc.org.
Here are two new ways to stay connected to Issues Etc., Facebook and Twitter. You'll find photos of in-studio guests at facebook.com/issuesetc, and you'll find a list of upcoming topics and guests on Twitter at issuesetc. Social networking for the thinking Christian, facebook.com/issuesetc, and on Twitter at issuesetc. Connect with fellow Issues Etc. junkies today, facebook.com/issuesetc, and on Twitter at issuesetc.
Welcome back. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc. We're talking with Terry Mattingly about several things. Right now, the Vatican and cyberspace. A little bit later, mothers and religious beliefs and a controversy surrounding this year's National Prayer Breakfast. Terry Mattingly is director of the Washington Journalism Center at the Council for Christian Colleges and Universities, author of the weekly On Religion column for Scripps Howard News Service. He is founder of GetReligion.org and author of the book Pop Goes Religion. Terry, still on the subject of the Vatican and cyberspace, it's very difficult to maintain when you're having this back and forth. You said before you were talking about bishops and whatnot, hearing what their people are thinking. Sometimes it's difficult to maintain civility in the blogosphere. Your thoughts?
Yeah, that would definitely be a downside. At the same time, though, that's true of the entire internet. I think it might not hurt some religious leaders to actually know what people inside and outside of their own churches think of their beliefs. You know, I think that as harsh as that is, I think the upside is bigger than the down.
I mean, the Vatican has had a website for a long time, rather useful resource. Are we looking forward to a time in the near future where we'll see a Vatican Facebook fan page?
Well, I don't know. There's already the YouTube channel at the Vatican. And Benedict's staff has a lot of his materials up. I mean, there's not a papal blog yet, but there is a popetoyou.net, which contains a lot of materials, in addition to the fact that already, you know, at the excellent Vatican website, you had the ability to get, say, his daily audiences remarks, you know, his homilies, his encyclicals, and full text of everything. Although I have noticed that the more controversial something the Pope says, the more likely it is to be posted only in Italian. So it makes it a little bit kind of like a preemptive strike on the world press.
One wonders, with the vast scope of the Roman Catholic Church, literally a global organization, one half, I believe, of all the world's Christians would associate themselves in some way with that. There's a lot of potential there, given the tool of cyberspace.
Yeah, I still think what the internet does better. I mean, it's sure it's good to post statements in a place where everybody can get to them, but what the internet is really about is small groups of people of shared beliefs somehow sharing information that they're interested in. So, to some degree, I find it fascinating that Catholics who are active in cyberspace haven't been doing it at the level of their parish. They've been doing it at the level of, like, very conservative Catholic blogs and very liberal Catholic blogs. It's almost like there are parishes in cyberspace. And in some cases, it's like, I can't find a local church that defends the faith the way I would like, so I'm a member of the following online community. To some degree, that helps people feel supported, but at the same time, you know, that online site can't deliver last rites, can't do counseling, can't give communion, and most of all, can't hear confessions. So there's no way cyberspace can solve problems. Cyberspace is where you discuss problems. Does that make a distinction?
Yeah, I think it's a good distinction. You have written recently about fasting, and this is kind of standard operating procedure in your tradition, the Eastern Orthodox tradition, in the Roman Catholic tradition, even in mine, the Lutheran tradition. Yet you find that there are kind of mainstream evangelicals who, for various reasons, are taking up fasting. What did you discover?
Well, you know, this came out of a book I was sent, and it was one of those things where you look at it and you kind of go, okay, what the heck? And then I realized, this is a book on fasting, and then I looked and realized this man had written a couple of other books on fasting. And the fact that the author, Elmer Towns, is the co-founder with Jerry Falwell of Liberty University. So I'll admit, I was theologically biased. I picked that book up expecting it to basically be a kind of almost charismatic fasting as power prayer. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
If you really want God to do what you want him to do, fast. And there's just a hint of that But it's very clear that Elmer Towns actually knows the historical background of fasting and is well aware of a number of different types of fasting traditions. And I was really amazed, A, that the book existed, and that it was the fourth book he's written on the topic, and that these are some of the biggest-selling books he's written. This is a man who's written like 100 books. So, you know, as an Orthodox Christian, this made me determined to talk to him. I was surprised to find out that he actually has had quite a bit of dialogue with some Orthodox people, including the famous Orthodox priest, Father Peter Gilquist, who used to be one of the senior leaders of Campus Crusade for Christ and senior editor at Thomas Nelson Publishing. Father Peter has actually been on the Liberty campus, it seems, a couple of times, and this is one of the topics he's talked about, as well as an Orthodox priest visiting Liberty University to talk about evangelism. Wouldn't you have wanted to be a fly on the wall at that one?
I wonder, because in all three of the traditions I mentioned before, the Roman Catholic, the Orthodox, and to some degree the Lutheran tradition, fasting is intimately connected, especially with the sacrament of the Lord's Supper and a high view of the Lord's Supper.
Right.
Is there any door open there among evangelicals, say even Southern Baptists, to understand that? Because that's a real part of the history of fasting in the Christian tradition.
No, there's nothing of that in there. What he realized was the degree to which fasting as a way of life was interlocked with prayer in monastic traditions. In other words, he didn't have a link. He didn't understand, as a non-sacramental Christian, he didn't understand, say, a link between confession and the sacrament, right? But he did historically know all about the links that, you know, that the role, I should say, not links, the role that fasting played in monasticism and in those kinds of disciplines. And he has a guide, like a list of several different forms of fasting in his book. And I'm sure any liturgical Christian would read that and have a couple of things. A bit of Lenten humor here. People might have a little bit of a beef with that, but they're not going to disagree with all of it, and I think they would still be surprised at the effort he made.
I was listening to a radio interview recently. A journalist, Jeff Charlotte, had written about the family. And when I first heard this stuff, I thought, this is so outlandish, it can't be true. And yet he talks on. And I was even more interested to see in a recent column of yours that there is some connection between this group, the family, you'll need to explain what we're talking about, and the National Prayer Breakfast. So from fasting to prayer, let's go there.
Well, I mean, the National Prayer Breakfast is done by the family, is done by the fellowship, this very mysterious group. I've heard from quite a few conservative readers who said, oh, Mattingly, I couldn't believe that you jumped in on the family, the fellowship with that Jeff Charlotte wild man. Well, the way I've answered several people's requests about that when I start reading someone like Jeff Charlotte, who would be on anybody's definition of the religious left, but when I hear him starting to make some of the same criticisms of an organization that I'm reading in material edited and handled by Marvin Olasky of World Magazine, that gets my attention, okay? And one of the most interesting things about this group is that everyone considers them to be so conservative, yet the more you dig into it, there's just no there. There's no coherent theological content to this mysterious group. And, of course, the National Prayer Breakfast has in many ways turned into kind of a festival of universalism, you know, in terms of we're not sure exactly which gods we're praying to today, but we somehow think they're all the same, so we're all going to sit here and assume that. That's not the sort of thing that many conservative Christians would warm up to. In fact, I know far more Orthodox priests who would not even consider attending such a meeting as those who would, you know, queue up to go. So the National Prayer Breakfast, as this kind of broad, generic tent, may be on its last legs because of this controversy. And what we could end up seeing is kind of liberal prayer breakfast and evangelical prayer breakfast and maybe the First Things prayer breakfast, you know, kind of the Judeo-Christian prayer breakfast and this, that, and the other. It certainly was a column I put a lot of thought into and did a lot of reading preparing to write it. But this subject has not gone away. Let's just put it that way.
What can you tell us? I mean, I was intrigued by what I heard from Jeff Charlotte, but what can you tell us we can say we know about the family?
Well, I mean, there's some pretty good histories of it. I would point people toward a cover story in World Magazine. If you're looking for a conservative Christian take on the family, they recently did a cover story about the controversial C Street house. I would assume that if you went to worldmag.com and searched for the word Charlotte, you wouldn't come up with a whole lot of references other than that cover story. You know, the history of the organization is pretty well known and pretty well documented, when it founded, who its leaders are. But this is an organization with no phone number, no press spokesperson, no office, no website. It has largely existed with an abject lack of transparency. So the most definitive thing we know about the fellowship is that it is not a public group. It is largely a group that operates in the shadows, behind the scenes, in secret, use whatever conspiracy-friendly language you want to use. But the fact is they're not very transparent, and even their conservative critics would say that's going to have to end. Chuck Colson has gone on the record as saying, for example, that the family is just going to have to come clean in terms of who it is, where it is, what it owns, what it's doing.
Terry Mattingly is our guest. When we come back, a few more minutes with him, and then it's time for Soundbite of the Week on this Friday afternoon, March the 5th. Issues Etc. relies on a small group of faithful supporters called the Issues Etc. Reformation Club. These people have pledged to become monthly or annual contributors to Issues Etc., and this allows us to budget our expenses more efficiently. Now, there are four levels of giving. The Confessor, $25 monthly or an annual gift of $250. The Apologist, $50 monthly or an annual gift of $500. The Reformer, $100 monthly or an annual gift of $1,000. And the Patron, $200 monthly or an annual gift of $2,000. Each Reformation Club member receives premiums like books, transcripts, and the I Have Issues t-shirt. You can join the Issues Etc. Reformation Club by contacting Craig. His email address, craig@issuesetc.org. Or you can call 618-223-8385. 618-223-8385. The Issues Etc. Reformation Club.
Listen to what you want, when you want. You're listening to Issues Etc.
40 Days for Life Spring Campaign is up and running.
This is a special commentary from the Susan B. Anthony List, named for the suffragette who was proudly pro-life.
The Spring 40 Days for Life campaign began February 17th and runs through March 28th. For 40 days, pro-life volunteers across America will keep constant, peaceful vigil outside abortion clinics, participate in pro-life community outreach, and pray and fast to end abortion. Thus far, five such coordinated campaigns have resulted in the closing of five abortion businesses, 27 abortion employees quitting their jobs, and 2,168 babies saved from abortion. As leader David B. Wright points out, and those are just the ones we know about.
This is Marjorie Dannenfelser, president of the Susan B. Anthony List. To join us in our battle for life, visit our website at sba-list.org.
Welcome back. We're talking with Terry Mattingly. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc. Just a few more minutes with him, and then it's time for Issues Etc. Soundbite of the Week. Terry, one more question on the family, or the fellowship, as you call it in your article. If I were elected to national office as, say, a conservative lawmaker, and I went to Washington, could I expect to be approached by the family?
Yeah, except that, see, here's the deal. Once again, one of the reasons that some people think their conspiracy is so powerful and so broad, I mean, you know, Hillary Clinton has been quite active in events involving the fellowship. I mean, see, at this point, it turns into like almost like the New World Order. I mean, some people are willing to get that paranoid about the fellowship. I'm not sure the paranoia is accurate. I would say these people just need to go public. They need to open up and put more information on the record.
About a month ago, we've got about a minute and a half here, about a month ago, you wrote on motherhood, fatherhood, and religious affiliation. What did you discover in some of your research there?
Well, that marriage is, whether or not a family is based on an intact marriage, may be the single most important statistical social variable in American life today. And, of course, this is not new, and this is especially not new in terms of studying the impact of broken homes on African-American life in America. This is something that's been discussed quite openly and bluntly since the late 60s and early 70s when we were dealing with the work of the late Dr. Daniel Patrick Moynihan, who, of course, went on to become the Democratic senator from New York. Moynihan, back in that time frame, late 60s, early 70s, basically Nixon years, Moynihan did a lot of research that concluded that if you wanted to know whether someone is going to succeed or fail in American life, the single most important variable is whether they have a father and a mother, an intact home. And there you go. There's another issue that churches of all kinds are probably not dealing with very bluntly from their pulpit. I know as many Southern Baptists who are afraid to preach on divorce as I know liberals who would be afraid to preach on divorce.
Well, we've noted, Terry, that it is one of those social ills and sins that has fallen off the radar almost entirely in American pulpits. Whatever denomination you want to pick, it will not be the subject. And often, if it is the subject, someone will be warned after their sermon, don't address that. We have too many divorced people in the congregation.
Yeah, you remember the True Love Waits movement among Southern Baptists and supposedly at one time Roman Catholics? I found it fascinating that many Southern Baptist churches did not get involved in True Love Waits, not because young people weren't willing to take the oath, but because it was embarrassing for their divorced parents to take the oath. Think about that.
So abstinence for the young, but for the divorced.
Confusion for the boomers, yeah. And then we've gone full circle. We've gone all the way back around to the issue then of where is this moral confusion coming from in millennials and young people, right?
We have come full circle. That's a great way to end our conversation.
Okay.
Terry Mattingly is director of the Washington Journalism Center at the Council for Christian Colleges and Universities. He's author of the weekly On Religion column for Scripps Howard News Service, founder of GetReligion.org, and author of the book Pop Goes Religion. You'll find a link to his columns at our website, issuesetc.org. Terry, thank you again.
You bet.